Welcome to the Zebel Rebel podcast. I'm Talia Herring, and this is the show where we rebel against the trashy habits that brought on climate change one episode at a time. In today's episode, I'll be interviewing Ari Lieberzin, the founder and general manager of Moled, an upcycling design platform. Pretty much, they take discarded wooden pallets that were transported during large cargo and save them from the landfill by giving them a new life as furniture. I actually did a Moled workshop a few months ago and made a bench out of these pallets, and it was so much fun to create sustainable furniture with my own hands. Plus, I love the whole messaging of a pallet revolution. Very rebellious indeed. I'm really excited for you to listen to this episode. And before we get into the interview, I just wanted to make a quick shout out and say thank you to everyone for the thoughtful praise about this podcast. Please take a moment to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, or if you're listening on Spotify, just click those 5 stars. We have some really exciting episodes coming up, and I'm always open to suggestions of who to have on the show next. And I guess that's my ad break. Okay, let's get to the episode. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited that you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask you, what was the initial spark that made you interested in sustainability?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I think it was in a very progressive and natural way. Like, you know, I come from Argentina. I'm living in Israel for 9 years. In Argentina, I had my own architecture studio, and I always loved wood as a material. Like as a kid and as a teenager, and I always loved to work with wood. And as an architect in my studio to my clients, like most of the interior design works I did, it was using wood. So somehow always all these wood pallets thrown in the street, it was like, you know, strange. Like it's solid wood, like not laminated wood, good wood, maybe in a strange shape, maybe not the most comfortable shape, but still solid wood thrown in the street. So it was always kind of a question mark there. And I will get to how Moled started, but it was in a very fun and natural way with friends that we joined in a competition that asked for proposals of what can be done with wood pallets, all this in Buenos Aires, yes? And, you know, since then, this was like 10 years ago, I get deeper and deeper into this world. And I learned a lot in this process. It's not that I study sustainability and I finish, I said, okay, what I do with all what I learned. No, I'm still learning, and I learn, and I hope we'll keep learning through the work itself.
Even thinking, you know, seeing something on the street that's getting thrown away and thinking about where does this end up and why are we not using it? Like that is the core of sustainability, of looking at our resources and trying to rethink what the end goal is and how to reuse it. So like that was like really innate in this whole conversation. How did that come about? Like what made you think that?
I'm a logic person. Kind of non-logic of throwing away a very valuous material that you say it's something here, it doesn't make sense. I mean, like many other things, in my case, I so connected to wood and design that, yeah, this is my way to bring nowadays the message of wait, let's change the system. Let's change the way I try to be aware of everything I do, you know, in my professional life and in my personal life. And I think that's maybe the strong explanation why I came up with this question and why it attracted me to join a competition that we have to work to develop proposals made up from this trash material.
Just general awareness. What was this competition?
The competition, after I finished architecture and with other 2 friends, also one of them architect, the other one a designer, we find ourselves every day working a lot in the computer, and we were missing a lot, you know, to work with our own hands like we did all the studies. So we start to have this religious encounter every Saturday in the terrace of one of my friends. And he had there a small workshop. So we start to invent ourselves all different kind of excuses and projects to work with our hands. And in one opportunity, Juan, this friend, came with this idea that he heard from his mother of NGO, that what they do, they collect all the discarded materials from construction sites. So every time they have different kind of, you know, spare materials, And every year they organize a competition to understand how to take out the maximum potential from the material they have. Always with the social cause, yeah, of course. So that year the material was wood pallets, and the theme of the competition was what kind of furniture you can develop with thrown pallets to furnish rest like the slums houses. You know, in the slums, the very basic residence.
Okay.
Neighborhoods. Yeah, the more like favelas in Brazil and so in Buenos Aires and all Argentina, all South America, there are a lot of them, unfortunately. So that was the idea, how to optimize this discarded material to furnish their houses. So we say, okay, let's sign in. And you know, we're designers, architects, we like the wood, we like very much the cows. So let's do it. And this is how we came up with the, you know, we said, we start to search a little bit what exists, because we didn't invent the pallets upcycle or recycle. I mean, it's something that people do it, but we realized that most of the things we search in the internet was like, you know, the wood pallet as is it with four wheels, and you have the table, the coffee table. That is okay. Yeah, I'm not against it, but I don't know if it's the most useful thing for furnishing an apartment. You know, it's big, So we said, okay, let's make something modular, let's make something flexible, let's develop something that allow to use this pallet in different ways. So the name comes like modulate your pallet. That's the meaning of molet. In Spanish, it's the same, modular to pallet. And we did the first prototype and we prepared, you know, the whole explanation, and we were super excited and we were sure that we're going to win, and we're not. We didn't win with nothing. And but of course, we keep going with our own projects and life. Actually, it was a really a little bit of frustration to see the winners, because it was not really connected to the main objective to give this solution. I mean, they chose really cool furniture, but
it wasn't so practical.
Yeah, it's not the most practical thing. One of the projects that I received a mention was like this big bed for laying to the sun, you know, outside. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the first thing you need in a, it's like, it was a, but the really winning was what's going on now.
For sure. Wow. I love that you took this idea. I mean, first off, the story is pretty much always listen to your mother, right? You guys have a mom that like gave this idea of this really cool project. You didn't win. You decided to make a whole business and a whole revolution based on this idea and this inspiration. I'm not even sure if they know the impact that that competition had on your life. And
it's funny because my friend in Argentina, 5 years after the competition that I'm already here and working on it, he was in a party in Buenos Aires and he met one of the girls that was part of the jury, and they started to talk about it and like, you know, and she was, yeah, remember your project, what amazing that. She started to give some explanation, but it was funny, like, it closed the circle.
That's really funny. Okay, cool. I want to also ask you, like, what do you like about wood so much? What's a fun fact about wood?
Of wood?
Yeah, why do you like wood?
It's a nice question. I think it's, you know, it's a natural material, and you feel it. Think that in a very unconscious way, everyone that touches, smells wood, somehow get this natural connection, because at the end, you know, it's a material that surrounds us all the time in the streets and everywhere. We are surrounded by wood somehow. And I think that from the moment that you start to touch it and smell it and breathe it, there is a very deep connection. It's a flexible material. I mean, it's a material that allows you to work in a very smooth and flexible way, different of metal, that it's totally different kind of work. It contracts, it expands. When you take the first plank and you see it, maybe it doesn't look good, and then you start to sand it, and suddenly you start to feel a different texture, and it looks different, and change the colors, and start to show up all these hide layers, hide soul. I don't know, everyone can connect in a very different way, but it surprises you. At the end, it surprises you. You never thought that this piece of plank can end up as a very beautiful, you know, coffee table, side table, chair, whatever. That's if you did it, I mean, you can have this connection even if you didn't did it. But if you did it, it's make it much more, you know, deep. I had one of the ambassadors can say from Molle, the very, like, she came alone, she came with the company, she came with the family. Yeah, and we did a very nice video from her, and she finished this video taking saying that, wow, I never thought you can get emotions with furniture pieces. And I think it's somehow connected, of course, to make it yourself, but also to this relation you made with the material.
Yeah, the mystery of it. I remember when I was in the workshop at Monet, like, they said, you can choose an ugly piece and you'll find that it will be beautiful. Because it may, you know, have a layer of dirt on top or like a little bit of rust that you can get rid of from the nails. But afterwards, after you sand it down, you'll see the wood looks totally different. It's like, oh, that's deep. That is like, we're getting philosophical now at a workshop. That was cool.
Totally. And I think also, you know, it's at the end, wood grows up with water because this is what they need to do, you know, trees to grow up. And we are water. So at the end, these people maybe don't think about it in a conscious way, but it's there. I mean, every time. And it's not a coincidence that many people love to work with wood, and many people that maybe don't even know that they love it. They have a grandfather that loved to work with wood, and those that have no connection after 5 minutes. And this is, I see it every day in Molet. I mean, 90% of the people that arrive to Molet is the first time they touch wood and they work with wood. And after 10 minutes, everyone looks that they did it for the whole life. I mean, the connection, it happened very fast.
For sure. My grandfather, I grew up in California, and my grandfather made dollhouses out of wood, and he made his deck in the backyard. And wow. he made the seating area for the little kids with the chairs, like everything was made out of wood. And it was so cool to like see him work. And it really is this whole connection, like it's like storytelling within an object and your relationship to it, and you can really learn a lot. So just when you mentioned that, I just got emotional.
and it's strange because you tell the stories of your grandfather and it looks like something far away, and in a way this is what we are bringing now, like, you know, go back to these basics that apparently was a better way of going through life.
I'm like emotional still. How did you go from having an architecture studio in Buenos Aires to come to Tel Aviv and establish Molet?
I mean, the decision we took with my wife, and like back in 2013, I had one daughter. Now I have two. So our daughter born in Buenos Aires, she was 1.5 years, and we decided to go out from Buenos Aires for an adventure. I mean, it was no any professional thing on the middle. It was just, you know, we get married, we had a daughter, and we said, okay, I think we always love to travel. So we felt it was the right moment to went out and try something different. You know, at the beginning, we thought about Brazil, Uruguay, blah, blah, blah. 2 years of processing this, we end up very happy in Israel.
What? That's how you made it to Israel? You just thought, like, let's travel, and you settled in Tel Aviv?
Yeah, like we knew that we didn't want to start traveling, but to settle somewhere and make, you know, a life experience somewhere. After 2 years, yeah, of processing and talking, and I had cousins here, and I had a long relation in the family, like 3 generations, very connected to Israel, always going, coming back. So they say, yalla, let's do it, let's come. And for me, it was really hard to leave my architecture studio, and that moment it was already working for 6-7 years. No, we are already on the loop, clients. I would say, okay, anyway. So we arrived to Israel. The first 6 months, I was totally double life. I was here physically, but my routine was still there, finishing works with my clients, because I was in charge of the design part and my partner there was in the field. So it was okay to keep working from here.
What kind of architecture work did you do? Who were your clients?
We did mostly like everything, but mostly interior architecture, like a lot of, you know, houses and apartments. For me personally, I always loved this blurred world between architecture and industrial design. So that was my, especially I loved especially small apartments. When I had clients with small apartments, that the challenge was to find the storage places that everyone needs. So I really loved it. This I call it micro architecture. So back to Israel, after 6 months, I started to, okay, go out a little bit here, understanding what I'm going to do here. Walking around Noga, I discovered a very cool place called Astudia of two Canadian girls that it was quite new. They opened it a few months ago. And the whole idea of this place was to offer craft workshops, DIY for anyone from different kind of materials and technique. Through this place, I met through Facebook, that this is the funny part of the story. I met, I see one of their posts from Astudia and they promote a wallet made from a sail boat from the talented designer Elisar. I really like the post and what the product, and I start to stalk Eli. And I sent him a message, hey Eli, I'm Ari from Argentina, da la la. After 5 minutes, he answered me, Ari, let's drink mate, you know, the typical Argentinian in Spanish. Long story short, the same day I was in his house, Eli's house, industrial designer from Holon. We talk, he presents all the studies he did. He just finished studies and I talking about Lima. Lima is the name of my architecture studio and all the project I did. And at the end, I see he have a upcycled pallet furniture, the TV furniture. I say, I have a project also made from pallets. I showed the PDF. You really like it. And he tell me, you can maybe do workshops in Astudia, you know, the place that you met me through. And I said, like, okay, we didn't thought in Buenos Aires about workshops. We developed all the mullet as a design system, you know, the rules of the system, but not as a workshop. But I really like when he throw it like an idea. And I also used to work with kids and I like work and also in the teaching the university. So somehow connect sustainability, design, wood, education. And I say, yeah, let's do it. And I was with this mood of adventure. Yeah, I went out to discover the world. And I did the first workshop. And when the first workshop finished, wow, the people were, all the participants, on high, but on high in a way that after working 8 years as an architect with clients, I never had this reaction from a client. And I understood that something deep was there. Still don't know what, where this will go, but I said, okay, this is something I want to investigate and I'm ready to invest my time and energy and understand where this takes me. Also symbolic, but for me was very significant, was for me the first shekel I put in my house since I made Aliyah. I mean, it was the first time I earned money here in Israel since we came, because I was working for my Argentinian studio. And since then was a very long process of, let's say, 3-4 years of understanding with the time, the potential and the deepness and the strong values that the mullet have. And every workshop at the beginning, I did like, you know, a workshop every 2 months. And in parallel, I start to work with Eli and Asaf, a third partner. And we start doing all different kinds of interior design projects. We open our own studio. We call it Dale. And we did mostly commercial, you know, stores and startups, offices and all this kind of architecture. But in my interior, I knew that mullet was much more special and I won't leave it, even if it's still not profitable and it's still not my base, you know, my income base. And we get to a stage that I understood that mullet was really unique, that the proposal that we bring, it was something that there is no others like this. And we had some conversations with Eli and Asaf, because after 2 years, they also start to help me with mullet. At the beginning, I did it by myself and we did the projects together, but slowly, slowly, they like started to join this revolution. And at the end of around 2016, we said, okay, we need to put all the energy in one of the projects and mullet is the thing. So we closed the studio and we keep doing, you know, this, and we unite the whole power in mullet. And even in mullet, we have a lot of stages. At the beginning, we didn't know if we should be a NGO or if we should be a business. But if we are a business, it's not a regular business, it's a triple bottom line business, and what it means to be a triple bottom line business. So as I said at the beginning, I learned a lot through the process. I didn't start this having the info. I learned it into action.
Wow. So you just mentioned the triple bottom line aspect of mullet, and I want to go into that because I think that's really It's really unique. It's maybe more expected for an NGO to be like, we're nonprofit, so we only care about our impact. But for a business to also say we care about the economic profit, but also the environmental and social impact, like how did that all get established and concentrated for Mollet?
Like a question that I had in my mind at the beginning of this dilemma was first the model, you know, the NGOs at the end, every NGO can be a triple bottom line business, let's say, and maybe the opposite. In terms of, at the end, it's something, it's give the frame and the rules. But I realized that if I'm going to be an NGO, my work is to go behind donations. I don't want to go ask people donations. I want to make something sustainable. I mean, I want that the activity can be sustainable itself and not depend of, you know, someone or a group of people that give us donations. So first of all, this was a very, very concrete thing that I say, I want to work. I don't see myself. At the end, we live in a world that we need the money. The thing is how you get this money and what you do to earn this money. And I understand when in that moment, I didn't know deeply this triple bottom line model or triple P, you know, people profit, people planet profit. Huh. The triple P model is the same. It's different way of
the same. One is a tongue twister.
And I understood that that model is what I it talks to me and identify me. I want to work. I want to earn money. We all need money, but the model, the base of the model is that every dollar, shekel, whatever you earn or you get the income, it means that in parallel you also make a positive social impact and economic impact. This is and at the end, it's to measure the social and the economy and the environmental in the same way that you measure the economic. I mean, the normal linear economy companies, they measure, you know, the economic finance variable in a super, super deep way, you know, how much in, how much out, how much deal. So the same in the triple bottom, but also with the environmental impact and the social. And it's all connected with all. It's not that I do environmental impact without thinking the social and I try to understand how I earn money, but it doesn't, no. It's all connected. So we have
to- Can you give me an example? How does that work?
So, like just an example from ourselves. Let's say I do a workshop, okay? And we have this social impact workshop that what we do is we're in contact with nowadays like 20 NGOs. Every NGOs have their own needs and their own lack of different furniture, beds, shelves, tables, chairs. I mean, in terms of furniture. So we have this information from one side and from other side, many different companies or families or whoever want to come and work with the hands and learn. Come to Mollet and we do this workshop and the furniture we produce in the workshop, it's donated to this NGO that we understood that they are missing their shelves. So now I will explain the three impact that we are talking, the triple P. So in terms of profit, let's start with the easy one. When I do the workshop, the company that comes pays me. Okay, I get money for it. I don't do it in a volunteer way. It's my work. I put here the material, my resources, the team. So it's super logical that they will come and they will pay me. So here we have the profit. Then we have the planet. We're not using new wood. I mean, I'm taking discarded wood pallets and I bring it to the studio. And this is what we do. And in this way, if this place were missing shelves, if those shelves you are going and buying to IKEA, that is also a very, you know, can come have someone, put money, buy it in IKEA and they have shelves. But okay, you are in this linear economy system. So in our case, the environmental, it's the material and it's the most maybe clear in Mollet. And the social, it's suddenly, I don't know, if this NGO are coming 100 people every day and these 100 people, now they have new jobs and they can use the place in a better way and their life quality get improved. So we are getting in this social impact. It's all connected. Let's say this no triple P, I buy new wood, come, make your furniture, go away. This can be the same thing, but in a linear way. So this is the way we explain. And like this, we have, you know, you can find many examples of, there is this great company called Kite Pride that's their model is also PPP. They sell the bags. I had to pay it. So there is money. The material is recycled. People that work in the company are women that they take out from the prostitution circle. And this is the way every time that you buy a new bag, you are collaborating with the material and with the society. And this is the model.
Does it actually work? Are you able to see that you can balance all three, or sometimes do you have to prioritize one over the other?
No, I mean, they are all the time connected. Like in some project or some kind of workshop, maybe it's, let's say if we compare the environmental and the social, maybe some of them it's, you know, have more predominance, but not. It's a very, you know, it's a sustainable model. Sustainability, the word sustainability sometimes is misunderstood and people associate it only to the environmental part. Mm-hmm. But the concept of sustainability, it's holistic. I mean, something sustainable, it means that it's sustainable in the economic wise, it's sustainable in a social wise and environmental wise. I mean, when you do something sustainable, you connect everything. I mean, it have its own challenges and of course, not always a straight way to get things done, and you have to find a way, because it's of course that instead of going out and picking up pallets from the street, if I have a telephone and I talk with the carpenter or, you know, wood storage place and I tell them I need like this, it's much faster, it costs me less money. But
wait, so how do you collect the pallet?
So we are part of an organization that connect companies. Like every company tells what discarded material they have, and they make the connection. So through this organization, we get to many suppliers that they say we have wood pallets, just come take it. And also with ourselves, we are with the, you know, direct relations with the factories, building sites, and also we go around, you know, the neighborhood and we pick up the pallets that are close to our studio. And this is the way, and we already built this net of, and we still search for new, you know, factories and companies that, at the end, there is this win-win situation. Yeah, every supplier or company or factory that we met, that they had this problem of amount of wood pallets that they don't know what to do, where to throw them, or they have to pay to throw them. Suddenly, when we come, they say, wow, it's like, I can't believe it. I mean, it's so magic.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win. I take you the wood pallets. Look what the things nice we can do with it. You are, you know, Roshaket. No worry about how to deal with this. And it will be ideal to have the same with every material. I mean, it's a state of mind. It's a state of how we do things.
Yeah, I think, at least for me, one of the challenges in having these three ideas bouncing around is just the problem solving of deciding, because there's always things that are going to be easier to do, right? If you order something that's sustainable, you know, I'm putting in air quotes, but it comes from a factory that isn't paying workers a fair wage, right? Like, are you actually going to feel good about using that product, or if it's shipped from far away and the carbon emissions and bring that over? Like, there's all these different factors. And sometimes for me, I have to reground myself and think about, okay, what's my actual goal here, and how can I problem solve in order to actually meet that? Because sometimes there's all these different ideas and factors, and like you're thinking about all these hypotheticals, and there's no winning in that. But once you like go back to what you're actually trying to do, like you could find a local version, you could find something that you could reuse and repurpose. You're explaining with solving someone's issue of they have these like wooden pallets, like they need to get rid of them. You're solving their problem. Yes, it's taking the effort to go and pick it up and the communication to coordinate that, but it really is a problem solving that is very logical. And I think it's just like rethinking it, and then you get to this conclusion that works really well.
Totally, totally. I think, yeah, it's, I think at the end, it's we need to find a balance, yeah? Or at least I try to find my personal balance. I'm not, I don't recognize myself as a fanatic or extremely sustainable person. I mean, I know that in my daily, I also consume things that maybe they are not the most sustainable thing, but
now we get to the confession time. What do you do?
And I think that it's in terms of, but if you are aware of what you do, how you consume, I think it's already a very big step forward that we can all have. I mean, I think, I feel that most of people, or many people, you know, we just act in a very automatic way. We born like, and we get educated in a chip that, okay, I feel that the new generation, it's already looking at it totally different. And I see it with my daughters. I mean, the awareness they have of the climate crisis. And when I was 10 years old, nobody talked to me about this. I mean, in terms, but when we, the our generation, you know, 30, 40, 50 years old, start to think how we can change our own habits and start you to be much more aware of the way we consume. So probably we can get the world to a very, at least one step forward in a good way, and not, no, stop this automatic way of consuming. So if you ask me, I think we need all to find a balance, mm-hmm. in a personal way, every company. And it's happening, yeah? You know, companies that ruin the world, and they know they ruin the world, and they really collaborate with those climate crisis, somehow today need to readapt the way they do it, or they know that the eyes are much more on it. And you ask me, maybe 8 years ago, when I was trying to pick up pallets or get connections with people that throw pallets, maybe they were looking at me like a crazy, and now not that crazy. I mean, and people come to the workshop and you talk about the climate crisis and everything, and it's not so strange now. And of course, I see a click and a difference before Corona and after Corona. Somehow the COVID put the climate crisis in a very, very clear way on the table. And now we cannot play it anymore as an idiot that we are not aware of what's going on. But it's a process.
How do you think Corona has created more clarity about the climate crisis?
First of all, I think it makes all of us understand that what happened around us is much more bigger than us, and that we as individuals are really, really small, and we're not controlling what's going on. But at the same time, I think it gives this message of we are responsible as a society of to the point we get. I mean, it put in our face in a very traumatic way that we should stop. I mean, that we're not living well, I mean, as a society. And I think that everyone as an individual, if you get sick, it's something like traumatic, suddenly happens. So, okay, you start to stop and the thing. And I think everyone had a lot of time to think suddenly and to be at home and to realize what are the real important things are. When you start to do this kind of reflections and analysis, somehow you go back to basics and you realize that the important things are much more basic than we think, and all this ambition, and suddenly you can be happy with less. I find this way, in a general way, I think this was the shock and you know, I bring to the table of this kind of different conversations in a direct way and or in an indirect way that we didn't have them before. We were in a much more automatic way.
I think also we are trying to blame a cause for Corona, and what are we going to do about this? And then you realize there is no person to like beat up or to like get justice for or to get revenge for. Like, we just had to deal with the reality, right? It wasn't to point fingers. It was just like, how do we keep each other safe? What is our responsibility towards society? There are fears, like the unknown, all these different components. And I think that's a really good parallel for the climate crisis. Because yeah, we can be like, big oil's to blame and governments should protect us. But like, in reality, what are we going to do about it? Like, we can't just expect policy to come into existence tomorrow and that's going to make a huge difference. Like, we have to take action in a way that's just like, pragmatic. And I think that was a really interesting parallel to see how people were like, okay, we're shutting down. We're just going to do it. And, you know, maybe that was also the government saying, like, this is our policy, and like the pressure from your peers to like, no, we're not going to go out to an event and we're not going to skip these guidelines. Like, it is really interesting to see how that's going to progress in this generation. I also wanted to ask, you talked about talking to your daughters about climate change. And I wonder, like, do you explain to them what sustainability is through your work? Or is it like kind of quieting their fears or explaining what our responsibility is? How does that work when discuss? I don't have kids. Like, how does it work discussing climate with your kids?
Yeah, it's something I learned day by day. I think in my case, because I in my daily work, they see it in a very natural way. So I imagine that somehow they absorb this. They see it and it makes, you know, the bigger is 10 years old, the smaller is 5 years old. They don't still do the parallelism of, okay, you are doing it with wood, we can do it well. But still, it's a state of mind that is there. I see that also in the school. It's something that they learn and they come back home with, you know, and they tell all different things they learn about the climate crisis and how we need to take care of our planet Earth. And I don't have, you know, this specific serious conversation about the theme. I think it's in a very, in a much more didactic and you know, natural way, the day by day. And every time I see they are maybe doing something wrong or so I make the stop and I try to explain them, but they are much more aware that what we, at least I remember from ourselves as a kids, it's a chip. And this is also for me, I think a kind of a signal of, okay, things are changing. I mean, there is a dialogue on this new generation that it's happening, it's there.
Totally. I was passing on my bike the other day and I saw a dad explaining to his kid. I think the kid was littering and put some trash on the floor. And the dad, in a very loving way, was like, we talked about planet Earth before, remember? We have to respect the planet. And then like put it in the trash. I was like, wow, oh, like on my bike, like this is so cute. Because
you know that it's funny that part of knowledge is also that we work one of the areas is education, and mm-hmm. we work with kindergartens and schools, and we have cool. these annual programs. Yeah, also the same values, but applied for kids. And it's super interesting because I had a few situations of parents coming to me and telling me, Ari, it's amazing. You know, my kid, we were just hanging out in the street and suddenly we saw a wood pallet. He saw a wood pallet and he started to explain to me that this is the material they are using for doing the furniture in their kindergarten and all these different kind of toys they did. And you know, people, kids from 4 or 5 years old, teaching their parents. So this is part of the change that hopefully will bring us to a better place.
Absolutely. Wait, so what do you do with kids?
We have the workshop area, the design area that we talk about, interior design, and the education. Education, so every educational institute, kindergarten, school, high school, they choose what fits them. And according to what they fit them, we build this program and we, like, it's structured by how to say, the circles that you go through the time. And at the beginning with the kids, you start working with them and to the kindergarten itself and how they together can, for example, okay, we need the hand for the backpack, okay? Okay, we can buy one.
Oh, that's cool.
They started to work on project for the, you know, for their own kindergarten. And then from there, we get to the city and we start to make projects that connect, okay, where the kindergarten is. Maybe in the, you know, park next to the kindergarten, we see that it can be good to do benches or whatever. And also we connect the kindergarten with some NGO from there. So we go in a very... process, in a slow process, going through all the layers. And it's amazing. I mean, we finish the year, those who do the annual year, they like flip their minds. It's really, and we see, we get amazing feedback from the, you know, from the team, from the kinder teacher, how do you say? The
kindergarten
teacher. Yeah, the kindergarten teachers. And at the end, yeah, it's, you know, give the kids material and tools.
Kids love learning. I mean, like, the workshops are a great educational opportunity for adults to kind of like channel their inner childhood and to be creative and to do something that they're not necessarily good at or don't know the rules to, and to kind of be in that childhood playground in a workshop. It's the same thing for kids, and that's really amazing that you guys have all these different ways of creating your workshops.
We had some super cool experiences having families that came, for example, Saba Rafi, grandfather Rafi make his 85 years old birthday in Molet. So he brings his whole family, three generations. And first, it's amazing if we talk about the wood, it's ageless. You know, he was this kid of 4 years old making his robot, and Saba Rafi making a stool for his daughter, and everyone working deep in his own trip and together. But you say, it's hard to find, you know, activities that connect both extremes in the same intense way.
For
even
sure.
The parents used to get into it much more, like taking the tool from the kid's thumb. I think it's really, really energetic, and it's amazing.
That sounds so beautiful, that imagery of that family. What a great celebration of the family and everyone's life. I want to ask you, if someone doesn't want to come for a workshop, are they able to support? Are they able to buy upcycled mullet furniture? Or do they have to make it themselves?
No, we always push to people that decide making by themselves, because, you know, it's an amazing experience. And it's, besides, you will get the furniture, it's super therapeutic. We call it, it's a creative meditation. But of course, that if somebody don't want and they want to buy the furniture done, or they want to make a project for, I don't know, a coffee shop or whatever. So we have this also service of designing and making all by catalog or custom, any furniture they want, and they will get it there in a very beautiful and high quality. Just everything still with the, also when we do this custom, it's always the same material. It's not that for custom we go for the new wood.
That's perfect.
Yeah,
I'm sure that a lot of sustainable stores and, you know, just like cool coffee shops would be so happy to also have something that's more sustainable and also keep like the minimalist aesthetic. And that's really cool.
So this is what happened with and that's what's the main transformation from my old professional career, that I work with different kind of clients. But let's say that the work was based around aesthetic and functionality. Now you still have the aesthetic and functionality, but with super strong values. So when a client comes to you connected with these values, so the product, the final product is much more, you know, interesting.
For sure. Yeah, and unique. What do you see for the future of sustainable furniture and upcycling?
I see, first in general, not only specific of furniture, I think there is an evolution for being much more aware of what we consume, where things come from. I think that, let's say in the if we talk about food, I think it's already a few years in the agenda to think about, okay, which kind of food I buy. I mean, at least in Israel, that food is so hot. I mean, people are super aware about the, you know, all the background of where the food comes from. And I think this will get to all the areas. Now you talk with most of people and now we're thinking about furniture, where the furniture pieces were made. And when I go and buy whatever, like people don't think about it. Or I think about it less than when they buy food. I think that with the time, this will happen. As we talk from the, you know, younger generations, they come with this awareness chip. Much specific about furniture, it's a good question. I, you know, in my daily work, I see how people get into mullet, and something, not all of them, of course, but a nice percentage of the participants, something changed in their mind, and suddenly they start to realize that they are much more capable of doing things. And I won't say that after doing the workshop, they start and furnish the whole house, but suddenly something in their automatic way of thinking change. What I mean with this, that maybe they did this after 2 months, they forgot they did a workshop, but they will need a stool. I'm sure they will have this question mark before they going out straight to IKEA or to Herzl Street or whatever. So this, it's also connected to the awareness somehow, but after you experience it and you realize first, how fun is it? Second, how good it makes you. And third, the connection you have with this piece of furniture that you leave every day in your house, So yeah, this will, I think, will bring the change and, you know, upcycled furniture and workshop and it's a signal, a good signal. It's more competence, but for me, it's a good symptom of, okay, we are more people doing the good thing to do.
Yeah.
And from the other side, you see that there are much more interest. And I see it mostly with the older generations and, you know, very old school way of thinking. And suddenly they come to Mollet or they discover Mollet, I don't know, because they came for a workshop. And it's like, wow. It's like, wow, in a kind of, wow, what a great idea. But at the same time, it's so simple, so basic. I mean, you come Mollet and everything is in front of your eyes. There is no any, you know, sophisticated technology. No. It's the most basic thing to do. Take, work with your own hand, and suddenly you have a piece of furniture.
Yeah.
So I want to believe, and I believe that this will be the, like, I assume that people will start to be much more aware in everything, and part of it is also the furniture. And if we will get there and people start to act and consume, I want to say also to produce, but to change the production system, I feel it's hard, but change the consumption, how everyone, because this is in our hands at the end. So this, I believe, that will start through the years to change.
Cool. I want to ask you one last question. Do you have like a call to action, something that the Zebel Rebels listening, can they join the revolution? How can they get involved? How could they spread the word about the work that you guys are doing?
So yeah, I suggest everyone, the first call to action is don't live in an automatic way. And you know, these question marks are really good. And it makes us to stop the automatic life we are in. And at the end, it's like everything in life. I mean, if you want to take care of yourself and live a more healthy life, it's not automatic. You just need to go and train or do some sport. And it's fun, but you have to invest effort to get there. And this is the same. I mean, at the end, the result will come and we will be much more healthier. But we need to do this investment and this effort. And the call to action, I suggest, is dive in whatever you love, dive in, because for sure there is different ways of doing things. And if it's that you love carpentry, so yeah, come visit us in Mollet and you will be amazed of the way we can do things. But if you like fashion, so there are plenty of things that you can discover. And if you like sport, there, anything for sure.
Yeah, keep going.
No, sorry.
I was just thinking that it kind of overlaps. Like when I buy secondhand clothing and I buy secondhand furniture, it's the same story of continuing an item that already exists and how to give another life. And when you're in a workshop and you're looking at something that's going to be discarded and how can I use it, or food that like you're trying to reduce your food waste. So you have a few scraps of random things in the fridge and you're thinking, how can I reuse it before it goes to a landfill? So it's the same questions that you would ask in all these different sections of sustainable living or rethinking how you would process these actions. So what you're saying makes so much sense because it doesn't matter what topic you're on. It's the same thought process.
It's a state of mind. I think it's a state of mind. And I many times assume that in Mollet, we're changing the paradigm of how we furnish and we design our spaces. I mean, this is what we're bringing and demonstrating in a very practical, hands-on way. It's not PDF and explanations. I mean, we are hands-on. And through this way of doing things, we're demonstrating that there is a way of changing the paradigm of how we design and furnish our spaces. But the same, you can take it to any industry and anything we do. And there is a lot happening out in the street. I mean, there is a lot of good things happening. And this is my suggestion. Just, you know, go out, discover what's going on. Yeah, maybe it makes a little bit, requires a little bit of effort, requires to I believe we are all like kids becoming adults. But if the curiosity is still there, so there are super, super interesting things going on. And it's a pity not to discover them and keep with the automatic way of, you know, living, consuming and not realizing that the time is now. Yeah, it's not, I don't know. And we see it and we feel it. Everyone is welcome to visit us in the Mollet House. We're in an amazing place in Bat Yam in the design terminal, and everybody's welcome.
It's a really cool space. I don't know how you found that. Yeah, I came for a workshop. I can tell you
I was confused. It was in Yafo or it was already in the in Bat Yam.
I was in Bat Yam. It's so cool.
You saw what a magical place.
Wow. How long have you guys been there?
So it's now 1 year, but we know the NGO already for many years, and we also collaborate with them for many years. Actually, when they moved to this hangar, was nothing. The place was under construction totally, and they have a huge yard outside that they have a social
nursery.
Yeah, so when we get there, like 3-4 years ago, was totally empty. I mean, this social impact workshop we did with the Joint, they came 300 employers from Joint, the organization, and in 5 hours, we built there the nursery, you know, stairs, tables, and all the fence, and with the 300 people from the Joint, you know, the Joint, the organization, the worldwide Jewish organization. So they wanted to make impact workshop, not just to make something for themselves. So we connect NGO, the out of the box NGO that they own the design terminal. So we build it together with this 5 hours workshop for 300 people. And after 5 hours, they had this nursery. So the funny part that 3 years after, we moved to this place that we were already in a very nice and strong relation. And now we are part of it. And it's really special place. And, it's very special because the values that the NGO, leads the NGO of design for good. I mean, our power tool is the design thinking. I mean, all the team, most of the team were designers. So, and we use a lot this concept of design for good. Design is not just for aesthetic and to have these expensive products in the storefront. It's to do the right things and to use the right materials and to understand the process in a deep way and in a sustainable way. So it's a very, very strong connection point between the NGO that owns this, the design terminal, and what we do as part of it. Yeah.
Sounds cool. Wow. Thank you so much for joining me today. This was a really interesting conversation.
Super, super interesting. Congratulations for the great work you do. It's also, if we're talking about what we can do and how people can get into it. So listen to Devil Rebel podcast. It's also a way of, because at the end you need to learn and to listen. And I'm sure that every story you do in this podcast inspire many other people, and this is, you know, chain effect that it works.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I hope so. I really do. Yeah,
for sure. For sure.
Okay. So thanks again for joining me for this episode of the Zevil Rebel podcast. If you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it, please share with a friend who would also gain a lot from this conversation. And join me next week as I interview Joseph Gittler, the founder and chairman of Leket Israel. And until then, stay rebellious. Bye, Rebels.